Good morning. This week's 75th anniversary of the Pearl Harbor attack brings stories from families and recollections of sailors who experienced the raid. But what about the long-lasting effect on the generation of Japanese Americans born after the war? Carol Hayashino, the executive director of the Japanese Cultural Center of Hawaii, gives us her perspective. And this being a Tuesday, we'll check in with news events taking Neil Conan's attention from the farm. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. The Hawaii Symphony's Holiday Pops will feature a guest vocalist, Natalie I. Kama'au. She's with us in our studio. And the Oahu Choral Society is preparing its holiday concert, Tidings of Comfort and Joy, for this Sunday. We'll hear from Artistic Director Esther Yu.
It's Tuesday, December 6th. That's the conversation starting right after this news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
Great many aftershocks to the 75 years ago Pearl Harbor attack that in some ways still being felt. Yeah,
certainly by the people who have been in families where these stories have been resurging, or
sure,
who simply experienced what other people believed about Pearl Harbor and about the Japanese Americans who were in the U.S. when the attack happened.
Yeah, especially here in Hawaii. Yeah.
You bet. We're going to talk about that first this morning. Now, this week's 75th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor, as you know, has been bringing with it recollections of Hawaii families and the now few survivors of the raid. But for many Americans of Japanese ancestry born just after the war, it also spotlights the seminal event that shaped their lives. Well into adulthood and over 20 years after the 1988 U.S. apology for Japanese internment, Carol Hayashino visited the World War II Valor in the Pacific National Monument just 5 years ago. It was the first time the native Californian had been there since the vacations to visit Hawaii family in her youth. That alone might not be so remarkable, but Carol Hayashino is also the executive director of the Japanese Cultural Center of Hawaii. We sat down to talk about why it took her so long to visit the memorial.
My personal life had a direct impact on my professional life. I'm a baby boomer. I was born after Pearl Harbor. My parents are Nisei, American-born Japanese-Americans, and my grandparents are Japanese immigrants. I grew up at a time when diversity wasn't in our vocabulary. We didn't talk about cultural diversity or multiculturalism. And I grew up at a time when we studied things like World War II or the history, U.S. history. There was no mention of the incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II. And when we talked about Pearl Harbor, it was only the factual history, the sneak attack, the bombing of Pearl Harbor, the tremendous loss of lives, and the heroism of the veterans and the civilians who were killed at Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941. During that time, growing up as a child in California, I would sink in my seat when we studied that history. And it was because my classmates would turn to me and ask me if my father was a kamikaze pilot.
So you were put in the position of having to defend yourself as an American.
I grew up feeling as if I always had to prove my loyalty to America in the same way that my parents and grandparents must have felt that they needed to prove they were American.
How did that begin to change how you looked at the rest of the world through your growing up years and as you were coming back to Hawaii periodically to visit family and then going to the memorial?
Well, growing up, because I had a sense of responsibility that, gosh, people don't know what happened to Americans of Japanese ancestry during World War II. People were aware of the bombing of Pearl Harbor, the aftermath, the U.S. entry into the war. There was some knowledge about the contributions of the Japanese-American veterans, but it was a time when there was nothing written about the incarceration of Japanese-Americans. During that same time, I would come, as a child, we would come to Hawaii, we would visit our friends and family, we would visit Pearl Harbor. and pay our respects at the USS Arizona. During that time, it was the same kind of, I suppose, guilt that I felt when I visited Pearl Harbor. And when I saw the film and when we would go pay our respects at the Arizona, it was, I always felt that I didn't belong. I did not belong there.
How long did it take you to feel that you did in fact belong? And not only did you belong, but that you had a pivotal role to play in explaining some of those feelings and getting the truer stories out, especially in the time that you're talking about, which was sort of the great American assimilation.
Well, growing up in California as a college student and then as an adult, I did begin to do much more research on World War II. And my interest in World War II, of course, was the impact that the war had upon Americans of Japanese ancestry. And I did make it my personal mission to document my family stories, to understand what happened to my grandparents and my parents. But also then as a college student, and it was during a time of the civil rights movement that I was in college at San Francisco State University. And my generation, the Sansei, the third generation of Japanese Americans, began asking questions of their parents and grandparents about their incarceration time in being imprisoned.
Were those questions welcome?
No, they weren't. In fact, it was very controversial during the late 60s and early 70s. It was a time where the Japanese-American community was not ready to talk about what happened to them. It was a very, very painful period in their lives. So there was that reluctance and the hesitancy and the desire to forget. They wanted to forget what happened.
And now that we know that we can't forget, and we're constantly told that if we forget, we're doomed to repeat, how do you look at where we are now in America's history and what the coming administration may mean for teaching some of the issues that you've raised that you had to go and seek out, even when there were those who didn't want to give you the answers?
Well, thankfully, during the 1980s, there was a movement in the Japanese American community to call for an apology, a government apology for their years of incarceration. And in 1988, the U.S. government did, in fact, apologize and noted that the incarceration of Japanese Americans was based upon race prejudice, war hysteria, and a failure of political leadership. And in an effort to never forget the past and to learn from the past, the Congress and the President, President Ronald Reagan, signed into law the Civil Liberties Act and provided individual monetary compensation to those people who were, in fact, incarcerated. Since that time, there have been a number of educational initiatives across the nation, including Hawaii. And the incarceration is now also taught in our schools. There are a number of exhibits. There have been a number of films, documentary films, on Americans of Japanese ancestry. I will say, in terms of education, I feel the same evolution has occurred at World War II Valley in the Pacific at Pearl Harbor National Monument. Now when I go to visit Pearl Harbor, I go through the memorial, I go through the exhibits, I'm able to not only learn the history, what happened on December 7th, and pay tribute to the thousands of soldiers who sacrificed their lives at Pearl Harbor, but I also appreciate the lessons that are being taught now at Pearl Harbor.
It took you a while, though, to be able to go back to Pearl Harbor. Why that protracted period of time between when you were a young person coming back here and only 5 years ago?
It did take me a long time, and I think because it was my own personal issues and my needing to also find a way to make sure that my experience, my family's experience, or the incarceration of 120,000 people was part of the World War II story. That has been a great part of my focus and mission in life, to make sure that the incarceration of Japanese Americans is not forgotten, as is fact, preserved. So that has been my focus. I always felt, because of my childhood years, I always felt that the Pearl Harbor story was not part of my history, only the impact of Pearl Harbor. But with the congressional apology in 1988, with the congressional and presidential apology and the reparations and the the redress and reconciliation that happened between the Japanese Americans and the government, I think it took that in order for me to reconcile also issues I may have had or many Japanese Americans have about Pearl Harbor.
Right, but that was 1988.
Yes.
And you told me that you only sort of went back to Pearl Harbor only 5 years ago. So there's a big difference,
yes,
of time between 1988.
There is a big gap.
And just 5 years ago now.
Yes.
So, but leaving that for just a moment, because people take their own time in coming to terms with things in their lives, as we all have experienced. But for future generations who may not have any of the ties that you have, except if they go back into, you know, their family's ancestry and they begin to understand some of that, but that's still just sort of on the page. What is it that you'd like to see happen so that children, particularly children within Hawaii, understand this at that level that you came to understand?
Let me admit, it did take me many years to revisit Pearl Harbor. And I have to share with you that I did not want to revisit Pearl Harbor. I had to. I was almost forced to. Actually, the only reason that I went back to Pearl Harbor to visit the new museums was because I was invited to participate in a panel to discuss Pearl Harbor and to critique the new exhibit out at Pearl Harbor. And that invitation forced me to then go revisit Pearl Harbor and see the exhibits and walk through it and take time to listen to the stories. And that was the only reason I confronted my past, my issues with Pearl Harbor. Currently, my wish is that we continue the educational efforts and the educational mission and message that is being promoted by World War II Valor in the Pacific, out at Pearl Harbor, the educational efforts of the 442-100th MIS Japanese American Veterans, and the educational efforts of the Japanese Cultural Center of Hawaii.
Should every child be taken there?
Yes, absolutely. You can read the stories, you can read your history books, but is visiting the site, visiting Pearl Harbor, standing at the USS Arizona, you get the sense of place. That's so important for students and individuals. The sense of place coupled with the stories of the veterans, I think, is critical to learning from the past.
Clearly, you have in many different ways. Thank you so much for making some time for us.
Thank you.
Carol Hayashino was born after Pearl Harbor and grew up in California. She is the executive director of the Japanese Cultural Center of Hawaii. You're listening to The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's now 8:17. Coming up, the Hawaii Symphony celebrates the season with a Pops concert. But first, here's your backyard quiz.
Ulana, Umau, Ukaholabe, Ohavai.
Today in the Backyard Quiz, we're thinking about an ocean-going vessel that became part of the history of Hawaii. At the time it was built in 1926, it was the most expensive and fastest merchant ship yet constructed in the U.S. It cost $8 million and represented the top of the line in luxury travel. It had 7 decks, a swimming pool, a ballroom, a gymnasium, and space for 650 passengers. With a 27-knot cruising speed, it could make the crossing from San Francisco to Honolulu in 4.5 days. Its trips to Hawaii brought thousands of tourists to the newly opened Royal Hawaiian Hotel. The hotel was owned by the shipping company which had built the imposing ocean liner for that very purpose. The synergy between a hotel and a passenger ship helped fuel a tourism boom for Hawaii, and today we're looking for the name of the ship. For extra credit and bragging rights, the name of its owner. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer, and the first one to get it right will get a prize.
Hi, good morning. I'm Reverend Dan Werning from the Hawaii Sacred Choir. You're listening to member-supported HPR2 live on the web at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Natalie I. Kama'au has taken her career as a concert vocalist to a worldwide stage, so her upcoming Pops concert with the Hawaii Symphony is a homecoming for a girl from Ewa Beach. It's a holiday music program, and Natalie's with us this morning in our studio. And welcome home.
Thank you, and good morning.
You don't get that many opportunities to be home for any long stretches, do you?
No, but when I am home, I still like to, you know, be able to share and perform. So I always ask my husband, who's my manager, to don't forget, if someone asks us to do something, it's okay. If I just got off the plane, I'll do it. I'll do it because I want to do for Hawaii, because that's where I'm from.
Well, how do you, one of the questions that arises when you just get off the plane and have to sing is, how do you keep your voice in shape for something like that?
I'm a really good sleeper.
Are you?
I'm a 9 to 10 hour sleeper.
Wow.
It's
an enviable gift.
It is a gift.
On
it's
a
probably
plane
the
or wherever.
Best gift. Wherever I am, I can definitely fall asleep and drink a lot of water, and I don't drink any kind of alcohol because that's not good.
It really trashes your voice, doesn't it?
It really does. It dehydrates you so quickly, and so it's a lot of water and a lot of sleep.
Well, you've had to learn a lot about just the kind of the science of preserving your vocal instrument,
yes.
Right?
Yes, and staying up late after concerts. I'm probably the only one who packs up everything and goes back to my hotel room and takes a long shower and jumps into bed and misses breakfast with everyone else. And I'd rather go and grab something simple just on the fly rather than, you know, getting up early and pushing myself. So it might seem sometimes that I just like to be by myself, but really and honestly, I'm trying to save my voice.
Well, it's kind of planning for the long haul, because that's what your career has become, right?
Yeah. I always have to think of tomorrow. I can't just think about right now. I mean, there are some times I'll go out to dinner and spend some time, but if everything starts to get loud and you have to push your voice to talk to people, then I just quietly excuse myself and go back to my room.
Do a lot of singers understand the things that you've come to understand about how to take care of your instrument?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
I don't think so.
I mean, I've seen a lot of singers who drink and smoke and
yeah.
And
you know, people ask me, how do you take care of your voice? And when I tell them, they just kind of look like, really, that's the answer? Is it really that simple? And it really is just that simple.
Yeah.
And sometimes after a really great show, you want to get together and everyone wants to party with each other. But what happens is everyone starts talking loud and the laughter really kills your voice.
No kidding.
So you have to just...
That's a depressing thought, isn't it?
Isn't it? I mean, loud laughter, wide mouth
sure,
laughter.
Sure.
But, you know, the cute little giggle, it's okay.
Well, good. Feel free to indulge in that
okay.
as many times as you want.
I'm
right?
a really good giggler.
Well, you're also a really good singer, and you have to take that to a bunch of different environments and often perform on relatively short notice, isn't that true?
Yes, sometimes you're not even prepared, and you arrive somewhere and they immediately say, okay, we're going to go into a rehearsal. And there are people in the rehearsal. You know, you're not singing for an empty room. And you have to remember that every person, whether they're there and paid a ticket, even if they're sitting in your rehearsal, they're
so
part
it really
of your
is,
audience.
It's half rehearsal, half performance. That puts a lot of strain on that particular event. Are you a really good sight reader?
I'm not a really good sight reader. I'm a very good listener. So
you memorize a melody from, say, a recording or hearing it played or whatever, right?
Well, yeah. I guess you could say that. I do read music, but I'm not a great sight reader. Mm-hmm. I love to listen and take it all in. And then I always have to put a spin on it. So I feel like if I have a sheet of music, then I'm like stuck between the black and white lines and dots.
Sure.
So when I'm listening to someone else sing, I'm already thinking, well, how would you do it instead?
Yeah.
And not to change it, but just to put my little stamp on it.
Well, a lot of the things that make a singer distinctive are not on the page, right? If you look at the sheet music for a song and then hear it sung by, you know, Frank Sinatra, you'll say, oh, wait a minute, right? Everything drops in at an entirely different place.
Right.
That's true of a lot of singers, yeah?
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, makes you recognizable.
Like, sure.
Even if they're not really sure and they turn on the radio and they're hearing, who is this female person singing? You hit that certain note in that certain way, and that right in that little puka, and they said, ah, that's Nat.
Yeah. Well, it also, a lot of nuances of timing come into play. You can come in with a phrase a little before, a little after, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you might make the audience kind of wait for you to
Or sometimes
sing a line.
You can't remember your words and you're listening to the music and then all of a sudden, oh yeah, that's what I'm supposed to sing, and boom, you rush it out with this big wave of power.
Uh-huh.
And everyone thinks, wow, that was so amazing. And you're like, thank goodness.
Well, it's because you've got to do a lot of thinking on your feet.
And I don't really like to use music. I don't like to use the words because I feel like you're not able to be 100% as an artist when you're stuck to looking at a piece of
music.
You
mean in performance.
In performance.
Yeah.
And so
people really don't want to see a singer reading. Or yeah, it just doesn't. You lose the, well, it's about a connection, right?
Yeah, you really lose that connection with the audience. And so this upcoming concert, it's, you know, it's all Christmas music. It's seasonal music. And so I haven't sung these songs for a year or maybe two because, you know, this season just comes just once a year. And so I'm trying really hard to memorize all of my words so that I'm not dependent on a sheet of music.
Well, sometimes it's tough to do. Your Christmas music is so familiar that sometimes it's hard to keep it fresh, don't you think?
Yeah, and I was outside just talking about how is the symphony going to take something that was just created with a guitar and a bass and a piano and translate it into having 60 musicians instead of playing it. I'm kind of looking forward to it, but I'm a little scared, I'll be honest.
Isn't it appropriate to generally always be a little scared before a performance?
I'm always, always super nervous, super-dy, duper nervous. But this one, I think, I don't know, I'm a little bit freaking out today.
And once you get going, Natalie, you know, it all sort of melts away, don't you think?
Yes.
That's pretty much how it happens in performance.
Maybe about a verse into a song and you can kind of get settled into the energy of the audience and the energy of the hall and the sound.
Audiences want you to do well, and you will. So there you go.
I hope so. I hope they'll come away feeling the spirit of the season.
Thanks very much for coming in, Natalie.
Thank you for having
Great
me.
Great to meet you. Natalie Aikamaau is the featured artist in the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra's Holiday Pops Concert, Sunday, December 11th at 4 p.m. And details are on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page. Thank you.
Hawaii Public Radio gratefully acknowledges Kule Williams of Honolulu, Constance Mariels of Haleiwa, and James Blair of Haiku for their recent membership gifts. Thank you to all of our listeners for your support. Today, the state school board is holding its discussion on education reform. School principals have already held their own talks. Will there be any cross-pollination? Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Why did the principals feel that they needed to meet on their own? I mean, since the State Department of Ed and the Governor's Task Force have been already meeting to prepare for the Every Student Succeeds Act, and that seems to give the principals a whole lot more relief. Were they not part of the process?
You know, it's interesting. One of the principals that our reporter, Noel Fujii, spoke with said principals are actually mentioned 167 times in that federal act, ESSA, as it's known by its acronym. And as you know, this is a major reform initiative. It has to be implemented by the 2017-18 school year. It replaces essentially No Child Left Behind, right? But what the principals were telling Noel, and the principals have been holding their own meetings, and they have met with the DOE on their own, they want skin in the game. They actually want to be involved directly in the process. They feel like they have a lot of good ideas. They don't want it just to come from that state DOE group that's working on something, the Department of Education, as well as the governor's own task force.
So what did they pursue? What do they want?
Well, one thing they'd like to have is more community input sought on how to best deal with their kids to help treat them. They feel that parents, community members are more better in tune with students rather than just relying on the principals themselves or the teachers and others. They feel that's an important thing. And as you know, a lot of this also revolves around testing. One of the things about NCLB, perhaps the most onerous part about it, was the testing requirement. The students had to be tested every year, for example, from third grade to eighth grade in math and English. There were other testings required for high school science as well. They were supposed to get up to 100% proficiency in math and reading, but that was really difficult for a lot of people. And the results of NCLB, that testing was actually tied to the educator's own evaluation. So these are the kind of things that the principals feel they have a lot of experience with, and they want to be able to, if you will, all be on the same page working on this major school reform.
I mean, you would think that they would be a component part of all of these discussions. Has there been any discussion as to why they weren't?
You know, that's a good question as to why they weren't originally included. But I think the point of Noel's story and the reality check today is they are involved. They, in fact, have met with school officials. And, of course, ultimately they will be responsible for implementing ESSA, which has to be done by next year, actually. And that's something they're going to be involved in. Basically, what we're talking about is a blueprint for public education, K through 12. And those two drafts, the one from the DOE, the one from the governor's task force, that's what the Board of Education will be addressing today. And you can bet that the principals will be paying very close attention to the outcome.
And any discussion or plan on the drawing board to be able to merge all of these things together? I mean, on one hand, it seems great that you've got all of this activity happening in different pockets, but the idea of being able to draw that together in a cohesive plan where you may have silos of information that may be thwarting each other seems kind of concerning.
Yeah, that word silos, I've heard quite a lot, and that's the whole idea, is to recognize that we're all in this together. By the way, the ultimate plan that's adopted by the state has to go to the federal government. The U.S. DOE has to approve that in order to get to federal funding, but we'll be following this very closely. Major school reform for the state of Hawaii. It's all about transferring power back to the states from the federal government,
which is bringing a lot of relief to educators in the state. But how they do it, well, we're going to wait and see. Thanks, Chad.
Thanks,
we'll talk to you in the morning. Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat.
Support for The Conversation comes from Hawaii Life Real Estate Brokers, serving Oahu, Maui, Kauai, and the Big Island of Hawaii. Listings and information at hawaiilife.com.
Back in the United States, it's a month after Election Day, and Donald Trump is making an even larger round of victory rallies. Plus, there's the tempest over Taiwan. For supporters of the European Union, there's a step forward and one step back. And then there's the anniversary of Pearl Harbor. Just some of the stories on the mind of news analyst Neil Conan this week. He joins us, as he does most Tuesdays, from his MacNutt farm on the Big Island. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
When we spoke last week, President-elect Trump was on his way to Ohio for the first of what he's calling the thank you rallies. Tonight, he's kicking off a three-state trip to North Carolina. Post-election tours aren't unusual, but in a way, these tours are happening. It seems to, again, be proving that Donald Trump isn't a conventional politician.
No, not at least on the evidence of that appearance in Columbus last week, where, you know, he started reading from the teleprompter, but as so often during the campaign, he went off the cuff to revel in his victory and exult over real and perceived rivals after making it clear, for example, that he had no interest in his campaign pledge to prosecute his opponent. We were right back to chants of lock her up in that rally and attacks on the news media. He obviously loves the attention and energy he gets from, you know, feeding his supporters red meat. We have to note there have been moments of civility since the election, even graciousness. We think of that meeting with President Obama at the Oval Office. But the Bulgarian populist lives in him, too. And Trump clearly plans to keep freewheeling in speeches and tweets, and there's no reason to expect he's going to stop after Inauguration Day.
You know, also this past week, we heard about that congratulatory phone call that Trump received from the president of Taiwan. Some would say it's not a big deal. That's what we heard from Vice President-elect Mike Pence. But others say that it's about time that somebody in Washington acknowledged, you know, reality, that there's a lively pro-American democratic government in Taiwan, whether mainland China likes it or not.
It's interesting, Beth Ann. You and I can call Tsai Ing-wen the president of Taiwan because, you know, that's who she is. And to go through, you know, the diplomatic niceties of the one China policy seems ridiculous, except it isn't quite so ridiculous in Beijing. Now, it could be seen as strange that, you know, the People's Republic of China, the Communist Party, is willing to accept that the government in Taipei is a rival claimant to all of China, the Republic of China versus the People's Republic of China. What they cannot and will not accept is an independent Taiwan, which, you know, suggests that a lot of other places like Hong Kong or Tibet or Xinjiang have legitimate claims to independence as well.
But a Trump tweet pointed out the U.S. sells Taiwan billions of dollars of worth of weapons. You know, isn't that a more important recognition of Taiwan than just a congratulatory phone call?
Well, can you think so? But no, not really. You know, the days are long gone when Taiwan could match the mainland ship for ship and plane for plane. Mainland China maintains a huge military advantage, with in particular something on the order of 1,500 missiles on its side of the Taiwan Strait pointed directly at Taiwan. Now, U.S. weapon sales are very carefully calibrated so that they don't upset that balance. There's enough to seriously discourage the idea that the mainland could take Taiwan by force, or I guess that they could do it easily. Therefore, any reunification would have to be political, something accepted by the government and people of Taiwan. Up to now, Beijing has been willing to play the long game and wait, but there's impatience now. More and more Taiwanese see themselves as distinctly Taiwanese, not Chinese, after the election of that independence-minded party in this year. And now a phone call with the president-elect encourages that tendency.
Trump has attacked China throughout the campaign. We saw that happening a lot. He said that they're unfair, they're taking American jobs. I think at one point he even said that China was raping America. Isn't Taiwan an issue that a President Trump might use as leverage in negotiations with Beijing?
Maybe. You know, Taiwan matters a whole lot more to Beijing than it does to Washington. One Chinese commentator noted that a president who wants help on North Korea or Iran is not going to get very much of that help from Taipei. Now, that ridiculous status quo we talked about earlier represents stability, a way forward everyone can accept. To upset that apple cart suggests that a Trump administration might either embrace Taiwan and encourage more moves towards independence, which China says it will not and cannot accept, or that he might then abandon Taiwan as that negotiating point. And, you know, what makes people really nervous throughout the whole area is instability and uncertainty.
Which seems to be a nice pivotal point to look at Europe. There have been has been plenty of news this week. We saw a liberal candidate defeated in an extreme right-winger for president of Austria on Sunday, while the moderate prime minister of Italy resigned after he lost a constitutional referendum. Both, though, were regarded as votes for or against the European Union, right?
Yes, and on balance, the European Union lost. In Austria, a candidate with, you know, neo-Nazi ties barely lost. And in Italy, a much bigger and more important country, the referendum lost by 20 points. Now we're setting up for crucial elections this coming year in France, in Germany, the Netherlands, and now maybe Italy, too. If you remember, a year ago when I was in Paris for the climate conference, we were talking about, you know, the European project, the ever-closer union that emerged from the ashes of World War II. And now we were talking as the French extreme right did very well in regional elections. Since then, Britain voted to leave the EU. Right now, the anti-European extremists have a real shot, not just in France, but in the Netherlands, for sure, and in Italy. These are all founding members of the EU. If the extreme right wings wins, they would hold referendums on their own about the future within the EU. And if any of those countries pull out of the EU, it might well lead to the unraveling of a political union that, you have to remember, was designed to contain the forces that led to two world wars in the last century.
Let's use that to take a look at what's happening this week in Hawaii. We're about to mark an important milestone of the Second World War with the 75th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor. And now we have news that we can expect a visit from Prime Minister Shinzo Abe later this month. He'd be the first Japanese leader to visit Pearl Harbor.
Just as Barack Obama was the first American president to visit Hiroshima earlier this year. And, you know, amid that reconciliation, we can step back a little to see Pearl Harbor. You know, there's a lot to say about Pearl Harbor, and we'll hear a lot of it in the next couple of days. But in a way, it's the pivotal moment of the past 75 years. We forget that before that day, there was a very strong isolationist movement in this country that resisted involvement in foreign wars. That movement melted away on December 7th, 1941. Ever since that day, the United States has been the preeminent global power. It rebuilt its enemies into its most important allies in Europe and in Asia. It established the economic and political conditions that led to unprecedented growth and prosperity. Now, of course, poverty and hunger and inequality persist in many places, not least in this country. But if you go back 75 years to the world before Pearl Harbor energized American engagement with the world, well, you can see just how profound those changes have been.
And worth noting that the isolationist movement that you mentioned was known as American First.
Indeed.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it there for now. Thanks, Neil. We'll talk to you next week.
You bet, Beth Ann.
News analyst Neil Conan joins us most Tuesdays from the farm. You can also hear his Pacific News Minutes right here on Hawaii Public Radio.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Matson, completing the 15th year of their Kaipu Aina program, partnering with charities that clean litter from our islands, shores, and parks. Learn more at matson.com/foundation.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want to do.
I'm wanting to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. It would be underscoring the obvious to say that parts of Hawaii are incredibly beautiful. We know this beauty attracts people from all over the world, and some of these visitors fall under the spell of the perfume-scented breezes and decide to stay, some forever, others only part-time. Some full-time residents have complained that the part-timers use up local resources and then leave, or they build expensive homes that drive up property taxes. I've heard folks say, those snowbirds come, they take, and they go. and they leave the neighborhood worse than before. Something should be done. Well, I'm happy to report that something is being done. On Hawaii Island, there is a community known as Kukio. Many of the residents are here only part of the year, but they came together to give back. These people want to change the fabric of the community. So far, they've raised $1.7 million in grants to support the local youth. This is a great example of what happens when a group of people, no matter where they're from, pool their resources around a common goal. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
And now we're going to get back to today's backyard quiz. We remember the days when the pink paint on the Royal Hawaiian Hotel in Waikiki was freshly dried. In that era, a luxury ocean liner brought mainland tourists to the islands and helped establish Hawaii as a tourist destination. The $8 million ocean liner, with its six decks and room for 650 passengers, represented the height of opulence in the 20s and 30s. Its construction included the latest in safety standards, allowing it to survive a serious collision during its sea trials. The impact of that 1927 collision was equal in force to the one that had sunk the Titanic 15 years earlier. Today, we asked you for its name. It was the Malolo, or Flying Fish. The ship went on to become one of the legends of ocean travel and was the pride of its owner, the Matson Shipping Line. Nobody had that correct answer for us today. Lots of people thought it was the Lurline, but no, it was the Malolo. So there you go. And we'll just keep our prize until tomorrow. It's 8:49. If you've got a backyard quiz for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
The holidays are best celebrated to the sound of massed voices. There's something about that huge sound flying up toward the heavens we'll forever associate with the spirit of the season. Two decades along, the Oahu Choral Society is preparing its holiday concert, Tidings of Comfort and Joy, for this Sunday. We talked about it with Esther S. Yu, the Society's artistic director.
We just celebrated last season, our 20th year. And I have been with the Choral Society since 2008. You know, we try to, our goal or our mission is to present the highest choral, great choral music to the Honolulu audiences or to the audience of Hawaii.
How many voices strong are you these days?
We are at any time around 90 voices. This is the symphonic chorus, and we actually just started a chamber choir last year with the help of generous grants. And so we have a chamber choir now within the Oahu Choral Society. So two choirs are represented under the Oahu Choral Society umbrella.
How many voices in a chamber choir? That's a smaller
unit. In the
unit.
Chamber, we have 24 members.
And is that a slightly different repertoire?
Yes, yes. So with this choir, we try to, I try to bring their great a cappella literature, you know, with a 80-90 voice, that's virtually, you know, impossible.
Yeah.
But with this chamber choir, I mostly have done, you know, the chamber choral music that is available, and that's not often performed in Honolulu. And the special thing about this chamber choir now, or at Oahu Choral Society, is that we are actually hiring singers to sing in our midst. So we have about 8 paid singers, 2 per section in the symphonic chorus, and they are also represented. They also become part of the chamber choir, with of course added singers from the symphonic chorus. And everybody is auditioned. So this is actually the only auditioned choir on the island.
What kind of things do you look for when you're auditioning singers?
Many things. Voice quality.
Pitch.
All sorts of things. But, I also have to think that sometimes, we live on an island, and we try to find the best singers that are available on the island. What musical skills? I mean, just where, their background also comes into play. It depends on which chorus they're, the audition is really for. So the symphonic chorus, I tried to look for people with some choral experience who have a good tone and who read at a much higher level. So that becomes important, and also kind of memory of, what they've just sung, how fast can they catch on.
I would think that the ability to read music would be extremely important in this setting.
It is important, but you have to remember oftentimes singers are not the best readers that we have. It's just, for some reason, the singers, they hear quicker, they respond quicker, but they don't necessarily read as well. And that is my experience, has always been my experience in all the conservatories I've attended. And again, in a choir, you're not singing solos, but you're singing with the person next to you. And, I try to find the best, the people who can really catch on quickly, some of them may not be the best, sight readers, but they certainly can, as soon as they've heard it once, they're very quick to catch on to it.
You have the advantage in a choral environment of, as you said, the person next to you, right?
Mm-hmm, of course. Yeah, so it's, so I try to bring kind of like people together, because it's important that they feel good about the person next to them, sitting next to them. Again, personality is also, I think, important, because after all, this is a community. It's a community of singers, and one of the things that are different from other musicians is that singers, they're very people-friendly people. They're very people-oriented.
Even in a choral environment with a lot of people, a chorus can take on a personality, right? And it needs to.
Yes, definitely. You have to have the right chemistry, I find. So that becomes important. And more important, in a chamber setting, even more important is the chemistry between the singers.
Well, Esther, let's say somebody is auditioning for, or thinking of auditioning for the Choral Society, and they don't think of themselves as a good solo singer, but they might be able to function well kind of blending their voice. Do you find that to be true?
Yes. Oh, definitely. Definitely. Most of our people in the chorus, they come from all different walks of life. They have choral, they've sung in universities before or in other community choruses. They're not all soloists. But they're, really great people who just have a real passion for singing. And I think that's also very, that's one of the key things that I'm looking for is, somebody who can really contribute to the Oahu Choral Society.
Esther Yu is the artistic director of the Oahu Choral Society and conducts the Honolulu Symphony Chorus. The Society's holiday concert, Tidings of Comfort and Joy, is this Saturday at 7:30 at St. Andrew's Cathedral in Honolulu, and you can find out more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page. In your talk with Neil Conan, Bethann, you got to make reference to a sort of what we're seeing as maybe a new era of shoot from the hip diplomacy.
Well, I think we've been seeing that all through the campaign, but yeah. Now showing how it will show up in the policies and the communication style of a new administration certainly is being evidenced by what we're seeing now.
Well, the world of international diplomacy is so full of protocols, customs, and, you know, the right way to do things, and we have a sort of a bull in the china shop effect going on.
Oh, just wait for the next couple of years. That's going to do it for us for this morning. Tomorrow's show, we're going to be taking a look at at Pearl Harbor through the eyes of a 442nd veteran. Also, we're going to be talking with the survivor of an internment camp that we don't much hear or talk about.
We'll also look at some unsung heroes of the Second World War and get a former Iran hostage's perspective on Pearl Harbor Day.
In the meantime, you can call our talkback line and tell us whatever you'd like us to know. That number is 808-792-8217. If you like email, you can get to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, on Twitter at HI Conversation, or you can get to me either on Twitter at BKOZHPR or on Instagram.
If you missed any of the show or want a past one, you can find them under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll see you in the morning with more of The Conversation.